These guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you've got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And here we are in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Steve Bertrand here. Welcome to Tuesday afternoon, and the Dow looks good. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. John Najarian is on a phone line, and he's looking at Wall Street. Of course, you watch John on CNBC, follow him on Twitter at John Najarian. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Great to be with you, Stephen. Thank you.
So in the past 20 minutes or so, we've had this breaking news regarding Michael Flynn, and I don't know that there's any reverberation on Wall Street. I haven't seen much, but an interesting thing that they put the sentencing off now, it looks like, until March, so he can further cooperate with investigators. I'm not sure I understand why he couldn't be required to cooperate after having been sentenced, but it was an unexpected development to me.
Yeah, it was unexpected here, too, but I don't know that the market had much of a reaction to that, but it certainly has had a nice reaction to the idea that the Fed may pause tomorrow, and that appears to be a significant driver to today's stock market action.
Pause and have no increase, or pause after tomorrow's increase?
That's the question. You know, there are some bets right now, although they're in the minority, that they may pause as in no move. They're choosing to call it, most of us are choosing to call it a dovish hike, because if they offer dovish sentiment after they hike tomorrow, that's how they're getting to that result. But I think certainly the Fed is in a place where they could pause, but I think it's probably just a little bit better than a coin flip that they give us a 25 basis point increase, but then they offer us those dovish comments rather than no move at all.
Right, because everyone's been predicting they're going to increase interest rates in December, I think, since last December. I mean, it'd be a pretty big surprise.
Yep. It would. It is still, even though it's been dropping the percentage, according to the traders at the CME group, the percentage chance has been dropping, but nonetheless, it is still, like I say, it's better, much better than a coin flip that they will increase rates tomorrow, and then the hopes are that they'd offer that dovish commentary. So, but it has come down. It was better than 90% not too long ago, and now they've been ratcheting that down just as the market has ratcheted itself down.
Well, it looked inevitable that perhaps that there would be a government shutdown, at least partial shutdown, coming up on Friday, and we keep getting mixed messages from either side of Pennsylvania Avenue, but the White House deputy spokesman coming out today and sort of indicating that they might find other funding ways for the wall if they don't get it from Congress, which would lend us to believe that a shutdown is less likely. How is all that playing?
Well, yeah, you're right. There's a lot of back and forth on that. The House isn't even going to be in session. And so there really isn't an awful lot that they could do this week unless they called an emergency meeting, which seems unlikely. So I think we're looking at the possibility of if they indeed could pull it from somewhere else, if some of the money that has been allocated and not spent could be used to offset this demand of the president, then perhaps they could get around a government shutdown. But that'll, I guess, as we get closer to Friday, we'll know more about that.
I think we're probably going to be well into Friday before we figure it out.
That could be, too.
I'm interested in this company, Tilray, that signed a partnership with Novartis. It's a cannabis company, right? And this could be a real sign of things to come.
Yeah, it's one that I own. I tried to get in it on the IPO. I was unable to, but I've owned it for quite a while. They signed that deal with Novartis, as you said, Sandoz, which is a division of Novartis. And I think just as Constellation Brands doing a deal with Canopy Growth, Constellation, of course, being a distributor of liquor,
right,
adult spirits, let's call it, they want to be at the forefront of perhaps some sort of either CBD or cannabis-based recreational products. And the fact that Tilray has this agreement today with Sandoz is further endorsement of people believing in the benefits of CBDs or cannabinoids. And even if people don't want to use it to enhance their mood, perhaps it can deal with pain and a whole bunch of other things.
Well, this seems like, is this the first real big pharma sort of marriage with the cannabis company?
It's the first that I could name.
Yeah.
And they are one of the largest, Tilray is. And virtually all of these, of course, are coming to us out of Canada. And that's because Canada could pass a law, and it's the law of the land across all of Canada, whereas we have state by state. And that's why it's we've got dispensaries in states, and we've got some companies that make things that help grow the product, but not a lot of growers outside of that are multi-state growers.
Well, no, there are a lot of growers out there, John. They just don't have the seal of approval.
Yes, exactly. And most of those are probably underground, even if they are above ground.
Let's talk about a couple of local companies. Boeing sort of fueling the Dow today. But I'm interested in Allstate. They announced a buyback and got a big boost in their stock.
Yeah, Allstate. They accelerated a buyback of $1 billion. Basically, they were out there with that news just yesterday, I believe. After the bell, and for that reason, you saw that pop in ALL shares. I think the one you also cited, Boeing, is very big because that's the second year in a row, Stephen, that they have done $20 billion. Last year was $18 billion buyback, and they increased the dividend last year and this year. So that's a pretty good endorsement of where they think their business is, to be able to give money to perfect strangers who just happened to own shares of their stock.
You know, that in a way prompts a question I remembered. I was driving in this morning thinking of you, and, you know, the stock market, very volatile. Things are down. The S&P, I think, was at its low for the year yesterday. People are talking about a recession next year and all of this stuff. And I remember one of the criticisms of the tax cut was that it was going to be a sugar high that was going to really fuel things for a short time and wasn't going to last. I don't have an opinion on it, but looking where we are now and what we've gone through since the tax cut, I mean, are the critics who called it a sugar high, is there merit there, or why are they wrong?
I think they're wrong, but the president made it look like they're right because he basically went after the tariffs in such a big way. Had the president not pursued the tariffs and instead had gone with some sort of negotiation, I think the sugar high would still be lasting. In other words, I don't think it would have been a pop in January, as it was, of course, and then a fizzle throughout the rest of the year. I think it would have been something that would have lasted throughout this year and into next year. But unfortunately, the battle that he's fighting, I'm not saying he's wrong, but the battle that he's fighting with these tariffs that have been imposed on U.S. imports into China, exports from us to China, as well as intellectual property theft, have really offset the benefits of the tax cuts and some of the other programs.
So it's the tariffs that sort of caused the crash, not the sugar crash.
And
we don't want to use the word crash, but slowed things down. John Najarian, listen, thanks very much for joining us. We won't talk next week, so have a great Christmas, and I look forward to talking to you next year.
I look forward to it as well. Thank you. Have a great holiday, everybody.
Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. You know, Kim did the sports there. She didn't mention that number 20 Marquette was taking on North Dakota a little bit later today. I bring that only up because number 19 Kentucky, they're not in action. In fact, it's been a very disappointing year for them. Louis Lazar joins us, the number one Kentucky fan I know. Louis, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Well, thank you for that spot-on introduction.
If you're a Marquette program, you know, being in the top 20, that's pretty good for us. But if you're Kentucky, you don't want to be 19.
No. As I said, I think in our last conversation, they're an iffy proposition at best this year, unfortunately.
Lewis writes for the Chicago Business Journal. A lot of it has to do with the airline industry. And one of the things, Lewis, you wrote recently that I want to ask you about is this Fulcrum Bioenergy. which I guess
right. United, they're coming to Gary. Yeah.
United is a partner in them, a part investor, or explain all that for me.
Right. Well, I mean, United very early on got into this whole biofuels, eco-friendly kick, and that was one of the ways they decided they were going to show their colors when it comes to eco-friendliness, was buying into this biofuels company at a very early stage, because Fulcrum just started their first factory in Reno, a refinery in Reno, in last year, and now the Gary one will be their second refinery.
And so they're burning, garbage and turning it into
garbage,
jet fuel?
Garbage, essentially. Yeah, and turning it into pristine-looking jet fuel, from what I can see in the imagery, anyway.
Is it magic? How does that happen?
Well, I don't know. They've developed a process, that's all. I haven't seen it in person, so I can't speak to exactly what goes on, but it happens.
They're saying the Chicago facility could eventually make 33 million gallons of biofuel a year, which is a pretty remarkable thing.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, I mean, United will be right here, of course, to take advantage of a large chunk of that, I suspect. But any number of other fuel-burning entities could use it as well, of course.
And how is United doing in the other airlines? The cost of jet fuel has been dropping, right, as the price of oil drops, so that's got to be good for them.
Well, it drops, it rises, yeah. I mean, I think lately there's been a little pullback in terms of the price, but nobody expects that necessarily will be the case over the long haul. So they're always planning for the likelihood that it will rise again.
But it's good to be in the airline industry these days, is it not?
To be what?
To be in the airline industry.
Well, yeah, it's always a challenge, but, you know, this is what they're paid to figure out.
One of the things you're looking at is United's records and online performance, on-time performance and all of that, but their growth in year over year. And, you know, I do a little bit of European travel and talk about that with people, and it's a good time to travel to Europe. The pound is down and things like that. It's sort of cheap to go over there, and that's led to a big increase in transatlantic flights for United.
Transatlantic.
Right? This is supposed to be kind of the quiet time for them, but it's been picking up.
It's been picking up every month, oddly enough. And I think, I think the exchange rate has a huge amount to do with it. And I think the lack of terrorism, until we had that incident a week or so ago, or a week and a half ago, which I think was the first big incident in a very long time. I don't think that's going to necessarily keep people from continuing to go over. But I think the exchange rate and the fact that there's so many more flights now to get you to Europe makes it a lot more convenient.
United's transatlantic flights were up 15.4% in November. Domestically, there was an increase, but nothing like that, right?
Nothing nearly that scale, no.
I think it was 5.4%.
People are traveling. I mean, there's no question about it. I think they've got more money because of the tax pullback, and all of this sort of thing is getting people in the air. They want to be going someplace.
And I think they should be going to Europe, Lewis. That's what I think. You and I have been talking for years, and I think maybe our first conversation was about this United Dreamliner, and it finally came to Chicago last week, right? But sort of just as a flirt, it stopped and showed off a little bit and flew away.
That tantalizing little thing, they flew it in for a day. Well, actually, they delivered it directly from the factory in Everett, Washington, to Chicago. So I think other United employees should get a taste of what it's like, because it's not going to be flying out of Chicago. That's the biggest. I've been on the United's case for a long time now about getting more of these new model aircraft flying out of Chicago, but they're putting them all on the East and West Coast, which is unfortunate for those of us flying out of O'Hare, but that's their strategy.
Is it even up and running yet, or it's still to come?
The Dash 10, the Dreamliner?
Yeah.
Well, that begins service from Newark to San Fran and Los Angeles on January 7th,
okay.
I believe.
Okay, so they haven't even started flying them yet. They're just going to start.
No, it's not flying yet. But they've taken delivery of two of them. This was actually the second. They already had the first one, but this was the second one that United has gotten.
There's an interesting thing with American Airlines, how they're putting, what are they calling them, service attendants?
Service analysts.
Service analysts?
Yeah.
Which to me means spies on their planes?
Well, yeah, I mean, they've got to keep a consistent service. I mean, this is something that their veteran regular flyers look for, if there's any lapse in service due to certain employees being new on the job or what have you. And I got to look at this onboard service manual. I mean, this thing goes on for pages and pages and pages. It's like a PhD thing. It's very complicated. I mean, every little part of every bit of the service, front to back of the plane, is detailed in this manual. And so, I mean, so just to get a grip on that.
So these agents are on there to keep an eye on the flight attendants. governments to make sure that they are maintaining the level of service, and that's irking a lot of people who are flying with them, a lot of the flight attendants.
Well, it irks the veterans because they think the veteran flight attendants, of which there are still many of them, that they're looking over their backs and second-guessing them and so on and so on. I mean, when you've been around the business for 20 or 30 or more years, of course, they don't think they need people down there telling them how to do the service.
Louis Lazar writes for the Chicago Business Journal. Listen, Louis, have a great holiday. It was nice to talk to you today.
Well, happy Christmas and Merry New Year.
There you go. We'll talk again soon.
Sure. Thanks.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. If there's nothing you hate more than going through airport security, well, then I have good news for you. O'Hare is getting a new security scanner that produces three-dimensional images for security agents to get a better feel of what's in people's luggage. But the bad news is that they won't be implemented until after the holidays, because agents need to get familiar and trained on the new machine. This is all an effort by TSA to help make the most frustrating part of your airport experience a little more efficient. These types of scanners have already been rolled out in airports in Boston and in Phoenix, so no more having to pour out those shampoo and water bottles before you get to the gate. But stuff going on this week? Well, just look at Chicago's business education workshops. Tomorrow afternoon, Wednesday, December 19th at 3 p.m., you can learn about the basics of employment policies, handbooks, and contracts as your company gears up. It's ideal for small businesses, but a refresher these days is always a good idea. So just RSVP and learn from the employment attorney Charles Krugel about the best business practices. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. In the studio now is Kelly Leonard, who is the host of the podcast Getting to Yes And, which is based on an improv principle. Kelly, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me again about Getting to Yes And.
So the podcast, we talk to thought leaders and academics, people who are writing books, all about how they can be more innovative and creative in their lives and in business.
And this week you talked to Chris Dudley. He's got this book out called This is Day One, A Practical Guide to Leadership That Matters.
Yeah. So I'm going to read you this quote from the book because I think it's great. He says, make every decision in life imagining how you would like to tell the story of that decision to a group of people you respect 5 years from now.
See, I read that and I've been trying to apply that, you know, like, yeah. Oh, should I get a Diet Coke or a Dr. Pepper? No, not quite those.
Maybe a bit more.
But it is an interesting thing, isn't it? Because yeah. You, if you do that, you take away the sort of the practicality of some of the decisions, right? Or the rationalization of some of the decisions.
Right.
If you can put yourself 5 years down the road and explain it, it's a little harder to do.
Yeah, what he's saying is that leaders need to have values. He said, if you don't have a leadership philosophy that you can explain to me in 30 seconds, you don't have a leadership philosophy. And then when we're operating from our values, we're not always going to make the easy decision. In fact, we're probably going to make the hard decision.
Do you think everyone, most people, have a leadership philosophy?
No.
I mean, do you think that?
I don't.
I do not. No.
No. I think they have... This is the thing. And the reason the book is called This is Day One is like, this leadership is day to day. And it's about the gritty details of how you conduct your business. And I don't think people think like that. They think their leadership philosophy is like marked on a stone somewhere.
Right. I was going to say, if I can speak for Chris Dudley, people think that it's 30,000 feet in the air,
yeah.
Or it's a big picture sort of thing. And what he seems to be saying... You talk to him.
Yeah.
But it is a series of days, a series of daily sort of moments of leadership.
It's moments, yeah. It's how you interact with your employees. It's how you decide to conduct yourself inside the business, how you decide what's important to you. It's maybe turning down some profit because that profit is ill-gained.
Right. And that's when you talk to the people 5 years in advance and try to rationalize it.
Yeah.
How or explain people? It, I should say.
Yeah.
So the idea too, if it's day by day, that means that if you fail in one day, you haven't failed from 30,000 feet.
No, you start again the next day. Yeah, right. I mean, failure is inevitable. And this is a very common thing we talk about on the podcast, which is we're all so afraid of failing that we make a lot of really bad decisions. When the fact is we are going to fail, we are going to make mistakes, and that just is part of our narrative, and you try to do better the next time.
And it seems to me that this is a book not just for the C-suite, right? This is a book for the crossing guard, or any of us, really. When it comes to, I mean, we also think of leadership as someone that
special.
special and like a shepherd or herder.
Right.
And
yeah.
I think you can be a leader without having a group of sheep following you necessarily.
Yeah. We have a phrase in improv called follow the follower. And the idea there is like sometimes when you're improvising, you're a leader and sometimes you're a follower and you switch that back and forth. And he goes into great detail about how people think they need to be ordained as these leaders when all of us experience moments of leadership, whether it's in our families or it's in a moment of crisis or it's in the C-suite.
Well, tell me, it seems to me he could be describing character as much as leadership.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in a philosophy of character, everyone has a character philosophy, right? What's yours?
I don't have that either. Yeah, no. And he also talks about courage, right? That it requires a great deal of courage to both have a defined philosophy and then stick to it.
Well, should I be coming up with a defined philosophy?
In your sort of leadership mode?
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, you asked me that question. I think, you know, for me, I really value kindness. And I value truth. So this idea of in
okay,
leadership.
Okay, I'll do that one too. Kindness and truth. That's
a good one, right?
Well, we have those, but we don't necessarily form them out. I guess that's my question. Do we need to tease it out into some sort of a statement?
I think so. I think that this is, look, when things go unsaid, that's when there's always confusion and problems. So I think we're always better writing something down, having an idea of who we are. Because the other thing is that can change. It's okay that can change. But get it down, say who you are, I had a playwriting teacher said, if you can't tell me your play in one sentence, you don't have a play. I think it's a very similar thing.
You know, Bertrand Russell once said, because I was always big in consistency, right?
Yeah.
Well, you got to be consistent. And Dudley seems to be arguing for that too.
Yeah.
But there's a famous Bertrand Russell quote that I don't remember now. But it's something to the effect that consistency is the respite for fools.
Yeah.
Something to that if you can fall back into that rather than expand or adapt,
yeah.
You know, it's a sign sort of weakness in an argument. How would he respond to that?
I think the reality is if you know that matters and contexts change, as long as you're operating from the framework of what does it mean to have integrity to you, that can change in any given minute. So leaders are best who have a clear sense of themselves, try to operate the most ethically, morally, and kindly that they can, and recognize they're going to fail, and they do better the next day.
A lot more from Kelly Leonard and Drew Dudley. I said Chris Dudley. I'm thinking of the NBA.
You are thinking of the NBA.
And Drew Dudley in the podcast, Getting the Yes And. You can listen to that at WGNRadio.com.
Yep.
Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Merry Christmas, friend.
Happy holidays.